Please continue to stand by. Your conference will begin shortly. Thank you for your patience.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for today's New GTLD Contracting webinar. I'm Nicole Davenport, New GTLD Communications Manager for ICANN. Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to cover a few things. This webinar is being recorded. Recordings and supporting materials will be published on the New GTLD microsite. The running time of the webinar is 90 minutes. We'll start with a presentation and end with a question and answer session. You can ask a question via phone or in the Adobe Connect questions and comments pod. Phone questions will be given priority, and questions submitted online will be answered if time permits. Dial-in numbers can be found on the webinar page of the microsite at http://newgtlds.icann.org/webinars. The conference ID is New GTLD Contracting. To enter the phone queue, dial *1. To exit the queue, dial *2. Please make sure that your phone is not on speaker when you ask a question. Now, I'd like to turn it over to Christine Ouellette, Vice President, GTLD Operations.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Welcome to this webinar, the contracting webinar for the new GTLD program. Today's webinar, we will cover four key areas. First, we will begin with an overview of the contracting process for the new GTLD program. Then we will be discussing the details of the contracting information requirements, or CIR, as we refer to it. Then we will be talking about the next steps for applicants and additional information, followed by questions. We anticipate the presentations will take 30 to 40 minutes, followed by question and answer time. We will take questions via phone as well as via the question and answer pod. At this point, I will turn it over to Rob Antrobus, Director of GTLD Operations, to discuss the contracting process.
Thank you, Christine, and hello, everyone. We're going to start out talking broadly about the contracting process, and if everyone can see the current slide, I'm going to speak to this pretty broadly, and then we're going to dive down a little bit deeper over the course of the next couple of slides to talk about each of these elements in a little more detail. And the intent here is to give you some sense of what the process will look like end-to-end and how we will be interacting with you through the course of the process. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the process, of course, is going to begin based on individual applicant or application eligibility for contracting, and there are several elements that consists of. Of course, applications will have to have passed evaluation, whether that be initial evaluation or extended evaluation. And then with respect to any number of exceptions processes that not all applicants go into, for example, objections or string contention, for example. But assuming that an applicant has become contract eligible, we will move into what we call sending out the contracting information request. And I'll talk on the next slide a little bit about how we're going to go about doing that in order of the current applications. So the contracting information request is our mechanism for requesting information from the applicants so that we can begin to complete the registry agreement. And Krista is going to talk about that a little bit further. We're going to send out the CIR and give you time to respond to that, providing your answers to us. And then ultimately, we're going to review it, make sure that it is fully complete before we move on to the next part of the process. The contracting information request exchange, again, is going to happen via the portal, so it will be with the current primary contact. One of the elements we're asking for is a contracting point of contact, and when we move into the next area of the process, which is completing the registry agreement, if the primary contact has designated a different point of contact to work with us during the contracting process, subsequent interactions will be happening with what we call the contracting point of contact. So based on the responses to the contracting information request, we are going to create an initial draft of the registry agreement. and then work with the contracting point of contact to go through review of that agreement and ultimately come to the conclusion via negotiation, or if there are no changes, simply agree to the contract and move into signing and then progressing with next steps. With respect to the last lane here, both parties will sign, and I think the key element for you guys to take away from this is that we move into pre-delegation testing as an output of having a signed registry agreement. So let's talk a little bit about how applications are going to move into the contracting process. What you see here is a little hopper full of individual application marbles, and of course each one of these having a different priority. This is the contracting eligibility queue, and as I mentioned a moment ago on the previous slide, applications will come into this eligibility queue based on having passed evaluation, having no objections, or having prevailed in objections, not being in contention, or having prevailed in contention. And this contracting eligibility queue is going to consist of any number of applications, all with their respective prioritization numbers from the prioritization draw. The way that we are going to select applications to begin the contracting process is with an objective of initially signing at least 20 registry agreements per week. And so what that will look like to you guys is we will take trying to back up the queue a little bit for the contracting process. Perhaps the first highest priority applications in the eligibility queue, and we will select those applications and send out the request for information to all of those respective applicants. And then based on the response as we get them, as we get fully completed responses, then we will move them through the process, ultimately completing signing the applications and moving into pre-delegation testing. And so you see at the bottom of this slide we have the information request, completing the RA, and executing and progressing to PDT. Let's now talk about each of those individual elements. So with respect to the contracting information request, the interaction with the applicants, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be via the portal, and you will be receiving your contracting information requests based on priority order, as I mentioned earlier. So we'll select batches over the course of each week, and we'll drop them into the queue for CIR, and that group of applicants will receive their CIRs and have time to respond to those. That interaction is going to happen via Salesforce. What will happen is that the selection of someone for contracted information requests will result in a case being created. You will receive an email similar perhaps to those that you currently receive when working on a case or with the customer service center. And that case is going to provide a link to you to complete a form also within the portal. And the form will be a structured form requesting certain elements of the CIR. Again, Krista will talk about that a little bit later. And we'll have some required elements to that. You will be able to attach documents to the form, all with the intent of providing ICANN the information necessary to begin completing a draft of the registry agreement. And so your response will be via the portal. Once you've responded, we'll receive notification of that, and we'll work with any applicants as necessary to ensure that we have complete responses. So there may be a little back and forth there as necessary. But ultimately, once we have that completed information, we will release it into the next phase of the process. And just another thing to mention here that one of the elements of the CIR, as I mentioned a second ago, is for a contracting point of contact. What's going to happen for the rest of the process is that is the individual that we will be working for So, for example, in the next element of the process, those communications will be via the contracting point of contact. So, with respect to completing the registry agreement, we will take the responses provided in the contract information request and create the registry agreement based on those responses. One of the elements of the CIR's request is having the applicant indicate whether they're requesting changes or not. And we expect the pace of processing to be dependent upon that. So if there are no changes requested to the registry agreement, then that application will be eligible for execution. And if changes are requested, of course, then we expect to go into negotiation and have conversations, again, structured conversations via the portal with the applicant. Once we have an agreed-upon registry agreement, that will be provided to the contracting point of contact for their review and agreement, and then that will conclude completing the registry agreement. And from there, of course, we'll move on to the next step, which is signing the agreement. This is going to happen via any number of mechanisms. We'll work with you guys via whatever is most comfortable, if that is wet signatures via mail and FedEx envelopes, or fax, faxing signatures, or signing and scanning and sending signatures back and forth, but with the intent to get the agreement signed as effectively and efficiently as possible. Once we have a fully executed agreement, that is again going to be logged in the portal on our end, and that will initiate subsequent processes. So upon marking that as complete in the system, the pre-delegation testing team will receive notification indicating that the applicant has a signed registry agreement and they become PDT eligible. And then they will accordingly be reaching out to the applicants to begin coordinating for pre-delegation testing. Some other processes do kick off at that same time. So, for example, the agreed-upon and signed registry agreement will ultimately get published as our existing, and the registry services team will begin some additional processes and collecting additional information for the registry onboarding processes. And so that in a nutshell is what the process will look like end-to-end, with the bulk of the interaction expected to be happening via the customer portal, via structured forms, or via cases regarding contract negotiation as necessary. And so now to talk further about the contracting information request and the elements thereof, I'll pass it over to Krista Papik.
Thank you, Rob. Hello, everyone. This is Krista Papik, GTLD Registry Services Director. So building on Rob's overview of the process, I'm going to discuss the details of the contracting information request, or the CIR, since this represents a substantial piece of the contracting process. So what information is required for the CIR? There are basically two buckets of information, some that applies to all applicants, which you'll see on the left side of the slide that's posted, and information that applies to some applicants, which is posted on the right side of the slide. There are eight elements in all if you're one of the applicants that applies to the some applicants bucket. We're going to go through the various elements in more detail in the following slides. The goal of the CIR is to collect as much information up front so we can efficiently move you through the contracting process. As Rob stated earlier, the CIR will be sent to the primary contact, who can then appoint a contracting point of contact. The CIR itself will need to be completed by the primary contact. Once it's completed, the engagement with ICANN after that will be between the contracting point of contact. Just again reiterating what Rob said earlier, the CIR and the contracting process are facilitated by the customer portal, enabling us to have efficient tracking to recognize actual processing efficiencies and to have better control over the process. Additionally, we'd just like to let you all know that this is an opportunity to get started on collecting these items now as you get ready to enter the contracting process or in advance of entering the contracting process. Following the webinar, we intend to post guidance on the CIR on the microsite so that you can begin preparing. So the first element of the CIR is the contracting points of contact. You'll need to provide three different points of contact in the CIR. This will be done via the portal as data entry. The contracting point of contact, as I mentioned, is the person who will be working with ICANN on your contracting process. That's the data entry field. You can add in who that person is. The second point of contact you need to provide is the signatory to the agreement. The third contact you need to give us is who the legal notices will be sent to under the contract. The contracting point of contact, as I said earlier, will engage with ICANN throughout the contracting process and up to execution. If the contracting point of contact is different from the primary contact, we'll be asking you to provide things like name, title, email address, telephone number, etc. If the signatory to the contract is not previously identified in your application, ICANN may perform additional due diligence. Registry Agreement, Exhibit A, Approved Services. All additional services, if any, must be listed in the Exhibit A. All additional services must match what was listed in your application. If there are additional services that will be added into Exhibit A, Exhibit A will be developed jointly between ICANN and the applicant. Specification 8, Continued Operations Instrument. You must attach the latest or most current draft of your COI to the contracting information request. As noted in last week's webinar, question 50 of the application provides for the assessment of the applicant's ability to meet the requirements of Specification 8. The scoring requirements of Question 50 in the Applicant Guidebook are distinct and separate from the requirements of Specification 8. Therefore, we've summarized the requirements of Specification 8 here in this slide. Additionally, we know that a lot of you have concerns related to your COIs. We're going to be kicking off a process to identify deficiencies with COIs, and we'll be reaching out to applicants in priority order to assist you with that. Changes to your application data. As we stated before, applicants must submit changes or must submit a change request when information in their application becomes untrue or inaccurate. All approved change requests must undergo a 30-day comment period. Applications may not proceed to the next step until that 30-day comment period has elapsed. Some change requests will require reevaluation. The process to submit change requests is posted on the microsite, as we've stated previously. With respect to the CIR, there's a checkbox on the CIR that asks if you have any changes that you need to make to your application. If you answer yes, you must submit a change request through the CSC according to the process that's posted on the microsite. If you have changes that occur once you have completed your CIR and move to the next phase of contracting, you will be referred to the change request process, and the processing of your contract will be delayed until the change request process has been completed. Cross-ownership relationships. Per the Applicant Guidebook Section 5.1, applicants need to provide a statement of cross-ownership if applicable. This statement must be provided or submitted with your CIR package. There will be a checkbox in the CIR asking if you have cross-ownership relationships. If you check the box, you will need to attach that statement of cross-ownership. ICANN does intend to post or provide a sample statement on the microsite contracting page, which we will provide you links to and more information about later in this webinar. The statement will include things such as ownership type, relationship, accreditation, and contact information. Specification 9, Code of Conduct Exemption Requests. Applicants have the option to request an exemption if all domains are registered to the registry operator for its own exclusive use. Registry operator does not need, the registry operator does not sell or transfer use of any registrations to any non-affiliate, and the application of the Code of Conduct is not necessary to protect the public interest. With respect to the CIR, you must check the box that you are requesting a Code of Conduct exemption, and you must attach a document with that request. Special considerations. Special considerations include IGO or governmental entities and community applicants. For IGO or governmental applicants, you must submit documentation of your IGO slash governmental standing. The evidence must be in support of your designation as such, and all documentation submitted must be on official letterhead of the designated government or IGO. For community applicants, specification 12 of your registry agreement must include all community registration policies and must match what was listed in your application. Specification 12 will be developed jointly between ICANN and the applicant. Applicants that are both IGO, governmental, and community must provide information outlined in both of the sections above. Requesting changes to the registry agreement. Module 5 of the AGB says, applicants are expected to enter into the registry agreement substantially as written. Applicants may request and negotiate terms by exception. Applicants who request to negotiate terms will take substantially longer to complete contracting. This is a checkbox in the CIR, so once again, the alignment says, do you intend to request changes to the base agreement? If you check the box, yes, you can either submit requested changes with the CIR when you return your response to the CIR, or you can check the box and submit your completed CIR package without your requested changes. And when a contract specialist contacts you later, you can discuss the requested changes at that time. Also note, the draft registry agreement, including PIC specs, is still subject to change pursuant to ICANN consideration of public comments and GAC advice. Next steps and additional information. So there are some dependencies, timetable dependencies on next steps. They are board consideration of outstanding GAC advice, board review of public comments on both the registry agreement, the draft registry agreement, and the draft registrar accreditation agreement. Board approval of the RA and RAA is also timetable dependent. The board new GTLD program committee has scheduled multiple meetings to address these issues. The schedule they have thus far is June 11th, 18th, and 25th. So getting ready for contracting. This slide talks about the things that you can be doing to prepare in advance of being eligible for contracting. We're going to be posting a contracting information request guidance on the microsite. We intend to post that by the end of next week. You can access that contracting information guidance which will help you figure out the different bits and pieces that you need to collect in order to provide to us to have your contracting process move as efficiently as possible. Once you've accessed the contracting information guidance, you can begin document collection, although you could also take the information you've gleaned from this webinar and begin now. You will want to check your COI to make sure it meets the requirements of Specification 8. You need to submit any change requests for any changes you've made to your application, and you should watch for posted updates, including the CIR guidance. Also, as many of you may be aware, one element of pre-delegation testing is to provide your registry data escrow contract that you have agreed on with an approved data escrow agent. To get a head start on pre-delegation testing, you could begin contracting with your approved data escrow agent sooner rather than later. Again, on the microsite, you will find a data escrow page that lists the approved data escrow agents. We continue to work with additional data escrow agents, but there are currently two that have been approved and are posted. Finally, here are some helpful links. The contracting page / registry agreement page of the microsite, the sample contracting information request, and we will be providing a sample COI for you to view, can also be found on the contracting page. The approved data escrow agents link, the change request process, as a reminder, is provided here as well, and the various ways that you can submit questions can be found also on the microsite. That concludes the presentation part of the webinar. We will now move to questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star followed by the 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you'd like to withdraw your question, please press the star followed by the 2. And if you're using speaker equipment, it will be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. Once again, that's star 1 for any questions at this time. One moment, please, for our first question. And our first question comes from the line of Charles Gomez. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chuck Gomez speaking. A couple questions. First of all, you were clear that the CIR will request whether or not an applicant is requesting an exemption with regard to Specification 9, but you didn't give any information beyond that. Has the process been established with regard to how the exemption will be granted, what criteria will be used to make that decision, and either way, when will that be communicated so that applicants have that information? That's very important for applicants who may request the Specification 9 exemption.
Thanks, Chuck. So that's still related to what the board's looking at right now with respect to GAC advice. So we will get back to you with an answer on that once we have better guidance from the board.
Thanks, Krista. The next question has to do with PDT timing. Sorry about that. How many PDTs do you anticipate being able to handle at the same time, via week or month? Is it possible to estimate that? I understand there are a lot of variables there, so I fully appreciate that. That kind of information would be helpful for all of us as applicants in forecasting, when PDPs may start for us based on our space in the queue as well as the contracting that's going on. Do you have any information for us on that?
Yeah, Chuck, this is Rob. So the initial processing availability for PDT will be 20 applications as well, and our expectation is that we will and can scale that up over time. And related, because I saw a question in the queue regarding the regarding scaling up for the contracting process and our initial objective of signing 20 agreements per week, I'll go ahead and answer that now as well. We do also intend to scale that up as well, 20 per week for both signing the contracts, scaling up from there, and PDT starting at 20 per week and scaling up from there.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Sarah Salvi. Please go ahead.
Hi. On an earlier slide, you talked about, you know, so once applicants make it through this process and in 20 a week, then they're sent the CIR information, and then they sort of, it's up to applicants to fill out that information before they proceed sort of through the process. And I just sort of wondered why the CIR information wasn't sent to applicants as soon as they made it through initial evaluation, because I think one of our concerns is that by continuing to set this sort of 20 applicants per week threshold, it's sort of, it's going to bottleneck a lot of the processes up, and so the more the applicants can prepare and fill out their information beforehand and be ready to sign the contract, the faster the entire process will sort of move through. So I just sort of wondered why there was sort of that 20 mark put in there and why the CIR information was not going to be sent out, you know, until much later in the process when applicants could really be doing work on it post-initial evaluation.
Hi, Sarah. This is Rob. Thanks for the question. I think, and sorry if there was confusion around that, the CIRs, we will begin to send those shortly after the board has approved the final registry agreement and we initiate the contracting process. When we begin contracting, we will initially be sending CIRs out, I think, at 40 per week to ensure that based on individual applicant response times, that the objective is to sign 20 per week. So if we front load that queue a little bit by sending out 40 plus or minus, it will, you know, we'll have to gauge it as we go along, CIRs per week, then we'll ensure that we're achieving 20 signatures per week on the output. Does that answer your question?
It sort of does, but I guess my initial question is why only 40 per week when you could send the information out much sooner to many more applicants? I'm just sort of curious why you're holding, you know, sort of the, just the decision around holding back and only doing 40 per week when you could be sending it to applicants as they pass initial evaluation or at some other stage that you choose, but at a much sort of higher rate, and then only have the applicants move through the contracting process, you know, in whatever rate that I can do, but at least then all the information would be given to applicants beforehand.
Yeah, thanks. So I think a couple of points there. First off, it's simply a matter of bandwidth, and we don't want to flood the entire process on the front with too many requests. And I think, second, we want to honor prioritization. And if we send out, say, 100 CIRs on the front end of this, then, you know, the larger the batches that we send those out in, I feel like the less that we are following what we've committed to as far as processing applications by prioritization as we enter in the next stages of processes.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Sarah, it's Krista. I just wanted to add one thing to that, which is also the reason that we're posting the CIR guidance is so that you're not prevented from starting pulling that information together. So when the time comes and we do send out your CIR request, all you need to do is fill in the boxes, check the boxes, upload your documents, and it will, you know, be reviewed and then sent through to the next phase of contracting. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Jeff Newman. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hello. Hello, Crystal. It's good to hear you on the ICANN side now. I have a couple questions. and I posted these to the board as well. But let me start with the first one being, you know, there's a reference that you made to having to list out all your additional or approved services. This has been a term that's been used for probably about 12 years that no one knows what a approved or a additional or registry service actually is. And so if you just send out a request to say list all your additional services, I can guarantee you that 99.99% of the applicants will not know what that means. I couldn't even tell people what that means right now. So I'm encouraging you all to provide very clear guidance as to what is a registry service that you don't have to list versus what is a registry service that you do have to list in Appendix A. That's the first one. So that's not really a question. It's more of a comment. The next one is more of a question, and I thought I heard when you said that you have to, if there's any changes, you have to, after the initial evaluation, you have to submit a change request. That change request has to be put out for a 30-day public comment period. So just to clarify, and then you said later on, sorry, that the signatory must have been listed in the application, whoever signs the contract. Is what you're saying that even if you're doing something as minor as changing, like a public company changes one of its officers or directors, that now you've now introduced at least a 30 to 60 or 90 day delay simply because, let's say, Neustar changed its general counsel, which is public record, in between the time that our initial evaluation passed and the time that we have to sign this contract? Did I hear that correctly?
Hi, Jeff. It's Krista. Good to hear your voice as well. So I think there were three questions in there, one relating to approved services, one relating to change requests, and one relating to signatory. Is that correct?
Well, the additional service wasn't really a question unless you have an answer. And I do have some more, but I wanted to stop there. But, yes, that's correct.
Okay. So approved services, you're not looking for a response on?
No, more just a confirmation that you all will post very clear information as to what is an additional service that you would have to list versus what you don't have to list.
So with respect to change requests, once the change request is approved, we do have to post it for 30 days for comments. With respect to signatory, again, if the signatory is not someone who was listed in the application, and in most cases, if not all, there are multiple people listed in the application, if the signatory to the agreement is not listed in the application, then that could be subject to further review.
Okay. Okay, so it doesn't have to be the signatory of the actual application, but it could be a person that is listed in the application, then that would be okay.
That's correct, Jeff.
Okay. Then my next question is on the COIs, and we heard the webinar last week, and we obviously heard what you said today. So, and one of the comments you all made is, you know, make sure that your COIs are correct. Well, my question is, with those that got a 3 on the COI, that means they passed evaluation, most of those applicants actually believe that what they have meets the legal requirements in Spec 8. So when will ICANN start sending out notices to those applicants that about the COIs that it still finds deficient?
Thanks, Jeff. We'll be sending those notifications out in the coming weeks.
Great. Okay, and then the last one is on, the last question is on data escrow. You all advised, and I think very wisely, that people should start getting their data escrow agreements. Has ICANN provided the escrow providers, or has ICANN approved a model form, a model contract for data escrow agents to use? And the reason I ask that is that usually, or in the past, ICANN has been a signatory to these data escrow agreements. So I guess my first question is there a model form, and B, does ICANN anticipate being a signatory to these data escrow agreements?
Thanks, Jeff. The template will be posted soon. And just as a reminder for other people that may have questions related to this, there are currently two approved escrow agents, and we have others that are interested in becoming approved escrow agents. And just, again, Jeff, we will be posting that form pretty soon.
Okay, and I guess the second part I didn't hear an answer to, which is, in the past, ICANN has been a signatory to the data escrow agreement for a number of registries. I'm not sure if that's uniformly true with every single registry, but is ICANN anticipating being a signatory to the data escrow agreement? And if so, how will ICANN handle that? And how will people submit that fully executed agreement for pre-delegation testing?
Thanks, Jeff. Sorry, I missed the second part of your question. You are correct that in the past, ICANN has been a signatory to the data escrow agreement. Under the new GTLD program, they are not. They're just a named, we are a named beneficiary, but we're not a signatory, so there's not really a process that for us to sign it.
Great. And I guess, the final follow-up is that, can we assume if ICANN has approved an escrow provider and an applicant has signed a contract with that escrow provider, that will automatically be deemed acceptable and that ICANN will not be reviewing those agreements?
Okay, Jeff, but I'm cutting you off after this, okay? I'm just kidding.
I promise, that's it.
I'm teasing you. If you use the template, then yes, that is a correct assumption.
Okay, thanks.
When I said cutting off, I didn't mean literally, but thank you. Do we have another caller?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Jeffrey Eckhouse. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Jeff.
Okay, great. So I had a few questions, but after the barrage of questions from Jeff Newman, I think he asked most of mine, and one was, on the escrow provider, the agreement, hopefully very soon, is in the next week or so, as, you know, these are things that we have to negotiate terms. You know, there could be some possible negotiation of terms, and these things are not always a quick turnaround. But I did have just one clarification question on the issue of the signatory, and because as looking through the application, I don't believe in any point of the application was there a request or a statement where the primary contact or the secondary contact for the application, that they had a requirement that this person would be a signatory to the registry agreement. I don't believe that was stated anywhere in the agreement, or that was, you know, it was just the applicant information was the full legal name of the applicant, and then the primary points of primary and secondary contacts, and those two contacts were to be used for management of the application, including responding to tasks. I don't believe that was ever stated anywhere in the guidebook that any of the people would need to be the signatories, and that if you made any changes, it would require further review. So you don't have to answer now, but it would be good if you could clarify that point, because maybe I just missed it anywhere in the guidebook where that's where it's stated, because I think that might be a concern for a lot of applicants, because that was never something that was stated up front. Thanks.
Hey, Jeff, thank you for your feedback. With respect to signatory, you're correct. It's not explicitly stated in the applicant guidebook. This requirement is actually a requirement of legal and of the contracting process.
So this is a brand new requirement that you guys are just letting this is just new. I just want to be clear on it. I'm not saying, you know, good or bad. I just want to be clear that this is the first time that you get that this has sort of been put out there.
So this is Alan Grogan jumping in. I'm in the legal department here. So in Module 5, we indicated that applicants would be required to provide information that included contact information and the signatory to the agreement. We're not specifying that that signatory needs to be any particular specified individual or title. We did ask, as part of the information in the application, that applicants provide us with information about their senior management or officers, depending on the nature of the entity. So for a corporation, we asked for information on officers. And we would normally anticipate that the signatory would probably be one of those people that was disclosed during the application process. If it's not, that doesn't mean that they couldn't be the signatory. It just means we may have some follow-up questions or due diligence that we need to conduct on the individual to, for example, to make sure they're authorized to sign, or if there's some other issue with that individual.
Right. No, that's fine. I want to make clear, because I want to make sure that as we go through the process that there aren't anything that could cause, like, for myself or for others, an unexpected delay. So that's why I just want to be clear. That's why it's a clarifying question, just so I just want to be sure on what it is, so that nothing brings sort of a surprise or unexpected delay, or which I believe a further review would cause. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Next question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Michael Flakey. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This question, I guess, is for Christine and perhaps Alan. In the slides, it was stated that the contracts would be posted after signing. My question would be, if there are material changes made between ICANN and an applicant during the negotiation phase, the first time the community would see those changes would be in an executed agreement, so there's no intention to make posting potential changes before execution. Could you confirm that?
So, Michael, this is Christine Millett. So, yes, all registry agreements upon execution are published as they are today, and that is the intent with the new GTLD registry agreements. However, depending on the change in terms, conditions, portion of the registry agreement, there might be a requirement for publication of that document for public comment. So that is a possibility, but certainly upon execution, all agreements will be published.
Okay, so that's positive to hear that that's a possibility. If I could make a perhaps a suggestion, to the benefit of those people like Jeff and I that tend to read all this fine minutia, would it be possible for ICANN to perhaps maintain a website where, if there are deviations, ICANN could perhaps compile those deviations which have already been approved, so that if an applicant or an existing signatory to a contract looks at something and says, hey, that's something I would like, it would make it a lot easier. So I think that would be helpful as to preventing this from being a treasure map where we have to go find the agreed-upon changes. So that's just a suggestion. My second question, if I could, and it's a follow-up on Jeff with regard to the notice of deficiencies regarding the continuing operation instrument. Will there be any type of priority with how those notices get sent? Will they be all at the same time, or what will be the sequencing in which applicants will get notified? And again, this is important for providers that have worked with number of applicants. So if they could see that, you know, applicant 501 got a notification, that means everyone before is okay. What can you give us some idea of the prioritization when someone can exhale that their COI has properly ticked all the boxes ICANN's looking for?
Hi, Michael. It's Krista. Yes. So the way that these assistance that we'll be providing with COIs, the way that that will be prioritized will be based on priority number, as you stated, but also on the applicant's eligibility to enter contracting. So meaning that they don't have, for example, outstanding contention, open objections, GAC advice, et cetera. So once somebody is eligible, then we would take those that are eligible in priority order and start working with them to assist with the COIs.
Excellent. And one final, if you will, process question. When the CRI provides that detail, I believe one of the comments I heard was that the negotiations would be taking place through the portal. Historically, contractual negotiations have been over the phone. ICANN and Jones Day on the phone with and registry operator and their legal counsel. Am I correct that the negotiations will not be that way, but will be exclusively through the portal? So can you confirm that, or did I hear that wrong?
Yeah, so, Michael, that's a great question. So, no, the process is kicked off through the portal, and the interactions are tracked through the portal, but the actual negotiation for those applicants that are electing to request changes to the registry agreement, those negotiations will take place on the phone or, you know, exchange of documents the same way that contracts are historically or traditionally negotiated.
Okay, thank you. Those are my three questions.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Stephanie Dashnu. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just have a quick follow-up to the question about the process by which contracting is going to take place. Does ICANN have any sort of projection for applicants that do wish to enter into negotiation about how long they expect this process to take, how much time they're willing to devote per applicant? Thank you.
So the estimated time for any given application is going to be entirely dependent upon how many changes and how long it takes to come to agreement between the two parties. The guidebook currently allows for 9 months for that negotiation to occur, and if both parties are working towards getting an agreement signed, the applicant can request an extension to that 9 months. But ultimately, the time that it takes is going to be entirely dependent upon what is being requested by negotiation.
Thank you. And I have a quick follow-up question about the cross-ownership statement. What types of relationships are going to have to be disclosed in a cross-ownership statement? Is this intended to refer to joint ventures for GTLDs, or will parent-subsidiary relationships have to be accounted for in this?
So if you look, this is Alan Grogan again. If you look at Module 5, Section 4, 5.1, subparagraph 4, it describes what is meant by cross-ownership. So it's basically the applicant must report any ownership interest it holds in any registrar or reseller of registered names. If known, any ownership interest that a registrar or reseller of registered name holds in the applicant. And if the applicant controls, is controlled by or is under common control with any registrar or reseller of registered names.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Jeff Newman. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I got back in the queue. Sorry, Krista. Can you go back to the slide on the code of conduct exemption? Is that possible? Because my question's on the, I think it's the third element, the public interest.
Sure, just give us a second.
Sure. Great, thanks. Okay, so that last element, the application of the code of conduct is not necessary to protect the public interest. So obviously the applicant can certify that, but how is that last one done, and how does ICANN plan to go about determining what the public interest is there and what are the factors they're going to use, and how long will that process take?
Thank you for the question, Jeff. So as we previously indicated, information on that process is still being finalized, and we will be getting that out to you soon. We know that this is a question that you have.
Okay, great. And then my next question has to do with the answer that was given, which said that the timing is entirely dependent on the number of changes. I guess this is a comment. If there are very few changes that are, let me go back. The problem we've had is getting ICANN staff's attention on these changes that are being made. So I wouldn't necessarily state that the timing is dependent on the number of changes. I guess the question I have is, what is the service levels that ICANN Legal and their outside advisors are going to live up to at the or after a requests are made in order to get back to those applicants that are asking for those changes? So that's my question. Thanks.
Thanks. How quickly can you negotiate an agreement, Jeff? I think that part of your point is it's not necessarily the number of changes, but also the complexity and you know, frankly, where the parties are on the issue, how much divergence there is. So that's you know, the points we'll take, and you're correct. What I can tell you is that we are committing appropriate resources to handle negotiations in the entire contracting process. So it's, again, just to echo what Rob said earlier, it's impossible to tell because it depends. It's dependent on the applicant. It's dependent on the complexity of the issue, the ability to come to agreement. But what I can tell you is, once again, we are applying the appropriate resources to handle these negotiations.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I mean, I think what I didn't hear, although you said you're applying the appropriate resources, I guess is the problem we've had is responsiveness from ICANN staff. So if that's answered by we're putting more resources towards it, then that's fine. But, you know, it would be great for you all to come out with some sort of service level that you plan on. Like if you send out the CIR and the answers are given right away, how long it will take ICANN staff to respond to that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there's no further web questions in my queue. You may move on to web questions.
So, Wendy Prophet will be asking questions, and we'll have the team here fielding responses.
The first question in the queue is from Tim Switzer. Do you anticipate that the 20 per week contracts could be increased as the process moves forward?
Thanks, Wendy. This is Rob. I believe we discussed this in the course of answering the questions, the live questions on the phone, and the answer is yes, we do anticipate scaling up from the initial objective of 20 per week.
The second question is from Dana Moe. How much time to respond to CIR?
Hey, this is Rob again. So we encourage response within 30 days, but again, the entirety of the contracting process is allowed for to be 9 months per the applicant guidebook. So it may take longer, so long as there is active, you know, progress. And just to add to that, a good point that the sooner we have the response to the CIR, the sooner that we can begin moving forward actively with beginning the registry agreement.
Thank you. The next question is from Tim Johnson. Will ICANN be publishing a CIR readiness checklist? If so, when?
Hi, Tim. It's Krista again. Yes, we will be publishing a CIR readiness checklist. We called it guidance earlier. I kind of like your term better, but we intend to publish that by the end of next week.
Thank you. The next from Dana Mel. Is the entire registry agreement published publicly? Sorry if I missed that.
Yes, I believe that we previously answered that, and the answer is yes, it will be publicly posted.
Thank you. The next one from Ruben Cool, if I pronounced your name correctly. As a significant number of TLDs are brand TLDs willing to opt for exclusive use, wouldn't it be more productive to have TLDs indicate they're going to exclusive use and trigger ICAM analysis?
Thanks, Ruben. It's Krista. Yes, so the CIR does have a checkbox that asks whether you intend to request an exemption, and if you do, then you will also be asked to upload that or attach that exemption request to the CIR response that you submit.
Thank you. The next question from Irina Danella. Will ICANN consider requests for bilingual agreements, original English text plus translation into applicant's language, as contract change requests? Also, will ICANN provide translation or will ICANN accept applicant's translation?
This is Alan Grogan again. So the answer is applicants are welcome to provide translations if they want to, but the English language version will be the controlling version, and ICANN would not provide the translation. The applicant would be responsible for doing that if the applicant wants to do so.
Many of the questions have already been addressed. We're sorting through to make sure we're not being repetitive. Just stand by for a moment.
We have an audio question from the line of Charles Gomez. Please go ahead.
Thanks again for letting me in once more. Regarding the brand TLDs, there, as you know, there were a significant number of comments in the coming public comment period on the registry agreement, noting the uniqueness of the brand single owner type TLDs and identifying the various issues there. And some of the suggestions suggest that there's be a special a base agreement that accommodates a lot of those concerns. Can you tell us what the status of ICANN staff's response to those kind of requests is right now, or what your plans are going forward?
Hi, Chuck. Thanks for the question. We're still considering those requests at this time.
And I'm showing no further audio questions in my queue. Please continue.
The next question in the queue comes from Maria Kolesnikova, if I said your name correctly. Please clarify whether ICANN is going to make a translation of the registry agreement into other languages. I already said that one, didn't I? Sorry. Moving to the next one. From Maria as well. If an applicant has to issue a new COI according to the latest ICANN explanations, will this applicant have to make an application change request with the 30-day comment period?
It's not considered a change request if part of the contracting process for the COI. So the answer is no. We do not have to go into a 30-day comment period for that scenario.
The next question is from Donna Austin. I'm confused by the answer given regarding change requests. I believe the answers are somewhat inconsistent with those given during the last webinar, i.e. minor changes such as change of director, et cetera, will be addressed at the time of contracting.
Sure, this is Christine Willett. We have not made a distinction between minor or substantive changes. So any change to an application at any time when the information in the application becomes invalid or untrue, the applicant is expected to submit a change request. We did mention earlier that if the signatory, the individual who will be signing and executing the registry agreement, has not already been disclosed as a stakeholder, director of the organization, that we will need that party identified. That would not be considered a change request, but that would be a part of the legal and contracting process.
The next question is from Michael Norton. Does ICANN have an existing contract with Commerce Department?
This is Samantha Eisner. ICANN has a current contract with the Department of Commerce to perform the IANA functions. In addition, the affirmation of commitments is between ICANN and the NTIA, which is part of the DOC.
Operator, do we have anyone on the line at this moment?
I'm showing no audio questions in my queue. You may continue.
Okay. We will give us one moment. We're going to go through the queue, make sure we've answered all of the questions submitted.
The next question is from Richard. One of the slides indicated that any changes to the standard registry agreement will cause delays. I don't recall for sure, but I think it may even have said significant delays. And so I'd like to know to what extent PICs, which will likely be unique to most registry agreements, are considered in this context as changes to the registry agreement. If they are considered changes, are you suggesting that applicants who have PICs will be delayed in the contracting process?
Thank you for the question. This is Krista. So we're still waiting to hear the board's response to GAC advice, and until we have that information, we don't have a way of answering that question. Thank you.
And we have a question on the audio sign from Michael Plage. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This question perhaps either Samantha or Alan could answer. In the guidebook right now, there is a stated 9-month period for contractual negotiations with an additional 9-month window if the parties are negotiating in good faith. Would ICANN be open in connection with a dot brand who did this primarily for defensive reasons to extending that window beyond the 18 months if they perhaps said, we want to come back in 2 years. We prefer not to launch this time and incur the additional cost. Is that something ICANN would be amenable to? Or will you make them sign a contract and start paying money?
Thanks, Michael. This is Samantha. We have not considered any sort of derivation from the contracting timeframes that are set out in the applicant guidebook at this time.
So would that be something, so how would an applicant potentially raise that? Would that be something they would raise during the contractual phase that they would like to sign at a later date?
That would clearly be something, this is Samantha again, that would clearly be something that would be part of individual discussions with the applicants who are applying to operate the registry.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm showing no further questions on the audio side. You may continue.
So thank you all for your participation in this contracting webinar. We seem to have exhausted the questions in the pod and on the phone at this point in time. If more questions come into the pod, we will review those, and any questions that we have not answered, we will certainly get an update out, a Q&A document out, and posted to the webinar and contracting page of the microsite. Thank you all again for your participation, and we will speak to you again at the next webinar. Have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude our conference for today. We thank you all for your participation, and at this time, you may now disconnect.